if I can be a winning Ryder Cup captain away, so is an exceptionally big deal, and it adds a lot to my legacy.
For the best Ryder Cup build-up reaction and exclusive interviews, go to otbsports.com/golfweekly and become an official friend of the pod now.
We are talking Lionel Messi and Mauricio Pochettino, of course, with Philippe Auclair. Hi, Philippe.
Hello. Hello to you.
Great to have you with us. So the ups and the downs of managing a Ronaldo and a Lionel Messi.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. Much ado about nothing, gosh. I suspect, all this. But so talk to us. It's 1-0 PSG against Lyon. The clock is ticking on. 76 minutes on the clock. And Pochettino says, you know what, Messi? You're off. And how, in your view, did Messi react?
Well, he wasn't too happy about it, that's for sure. His expression, both when he was taken off and also when we saw him on the bench afterwards, and you could be sure that, of course, the people who were conducting the and producing the program made absolutely sure we could see how Messi was reacting to that. And believe me, obviously, a lot of the commentary was about the way that Messi was reacting to it. He wasn't too keen, basically, on being replaced. He obviously was flummoxed. Flabbergasted, all the rest of it, but we now know why he was substituted, and thanks to Mauricio Pochettino, who talked to the media before Paris Saint-Germain visits to Metz tomorrow evening in the French League, and apparently he had a knock on his left knee, and he will miss the game against Metz, and it's actually even possible that he might miss the game against Manchester City. This is at least what is in the PSG statement. And this might actually make the tongues wag a little bit less in France, because you can imagine it's just insane. I mean, as soon as Messi, there's anything to do with Messi and PSG, everything is headlines, everything is, it's not overhyped, it's uber-hyped. I don't know, I don't have a word for it, but everything matters. But perhaps this will actually calm the waters a little bit for Mauricio Pochettino, because there were already pieces in the French press saying that Pochettino was under pressure and that the people in Doha were not too happy about his choice, and that he had been told so, and people were wondering, well, is his place already endangered at PSG, when he's in fact extended his contract to June 2023 just a couple of months ago. So it's made quite a few waves in the strange Messi-obsessed landscape of Ligue 1 at the moment.
Yeah, well, it seems Messi had an MRI this morning, which confirmed signs of bruising on the bone. So follow-up examination to be carried out in 48 hours. What Pochettino said was, in order to explain, on the sidelines, we observe all the players, everything that's happening during games. We saw Messi was checking his knee and made some gestures, and we saw that when he took a shot. He said of Messi's reaction, of course all top players want to be on the pitch at all times. It's understandable. I'm calm about it. As for his reaction, I asked him how he was. He said he was okay. That was it. That was our exchange. And there was that moment where, now with his interpretation, you can see him as Messi walks by him and pretty much dodges his hand. Messi looks back and it's clear Pochettino saying, you okay? And Messi sort of in his very typical way, not giving much away. I guess the point is, so the rights and wrongs of this ultimately don't matter. Like, but the fact is, we are talking about a substitution, and it makes global headlines. And even like the parallel with Solskjaer and Ronaldo, like, it turns out Ronaldo, I didn't even catch this during the game, but Ronaldo stood up when there was a bad refereeing decision against Young Boys beside Solskjaer, and Rio Ferdinand goes on BT Sport afterwards and says, well, look, this shows he's undermining the manager, you know, a bit like the Euro 2016 final. And Solskjaer just has to spend 2 or 3 days explaining that one away. And you stop and you think to yourself, managing Messi, managing Ronaldo, it is just ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. And that's why their teams have got problems at times. And in one way, you could see that as being a lightning rod for not asking the right questions, because anybody who saw that game between PSG and Lyon, and it was actually a cracking game, would come up with very different questions, as in PSG won, but PSG won through a very generous penalty award, to say the least. And to a goal, quite a good goal actually, scored by a substitute Mauro Icardi in added time. But the team that played all of the football on that evening, regardless of the possession stats or whatever, the team that played the football and which really caught the eye was not Paris Saint-Germain, it was Lyon. and the players who caught the eye were also Lyon players. Which should be really the thing that preoccupies people who follow PSG and who are worried about their state at the moment. I mean, to be honest, it's a kind of worry that is very relative, because if you look at what they've done in the French league so far, six game play, six victories, they're not too badly there. Against the league, against Club Brugge, who again were a team were superior, I think, in every compartment of the match to the Parisians. In a way, when you talk about Neymar and Mbappe and now about Lionel Messi, you kind of move the conversation to a place that is both less comfortable and far more comfortable. Because, yes, it's less comfortable, obviously, is the whole kind of FC Hollywood kind of, you know, what's the relationship between the players and Pochettino? Has he lost the player? What's the balance of power between all these big guys in the dressing room? But if you do that, you're not questioning, you're not putting the real questions to Pochettino and to PSG, which is the fact that his team just plays bad football, really bad football, and is completely unbalanced, despite having a squad, which is perhaps, in terms of the raw quality, if you look at each player individually, not at the ensemble, at each player individually, perhaps the strongest ever assembled by a French team in history. And they're not playing good football. And they looked really, really bothered against Lyon. The midfield wasn't there. There was no protection whatsoever. There were acres of space for the Lyon creators to exploit, which they did very well indeed. And you're thinking, well, against a team that is a little bit more dangerous in terms of the forward power than Lyon, surely they will pay the price for that lack of balance at some point. So when you talk about Messi, you don't talk about that.
No. And the shape, you can confirm, I saw from the Lyon game, it was Herrera and Gay as the two in front of the back four. And then
shape
was,
is a generous shape is a generous is word to
okay.
use. Yes.
Well, just for the listeners, yes. It was supposedly those two in front of the back four, and then a three of Di Maria, Messi through the middle, Neymar on the left, and Mbappe up top. So I presume that's not the most hard-working team without the ball at the moment.
No, it's not. And strangely enough, actually, we saw Messi, actually, I think he gave a free kick by tracking back, actually, a dangerous free kick away. Neymar as well was doing what Neymar does, which is that he doesn't really cover his defenders or his midfield, but he reacts. Like he gets very angry if he loses the ball and if he sees that the team is not doing well. But it's all not Pochettino-esque at all. Mbappe is, that's not his main quality either. And yes, you have a huge problem, and we saw that again. I mean, the number of times where we saw suddenly Kakré, for example, within 20 yards of space in the PSG camp when the score was 1-0 or 1-0, and you thought, that's impossible. That shouldn't be happening. Well, it was happening because if you are that midfield, they didn't have Verratti, which is big miss, but to be honest, they have got plenty of other very, very fine midfielders. But when you're part of that midfield, if you see that your opponent is doing more or less what they want 50 yards away from goal, are you going to push and try to pressurize them and get the ball back? No, you're not going to do that, because you know that the guys up front are not going to do their job. So they won't be in the right positions. They won't do the necessary efforts. So what you could do is actually create yet more space between the lines. And all it takes then is a ball through those lines. And suddenly you've got your defenders in front of the attackers with absolutely no cover from the midfield. So you can't do that. And that's what's been happening. That was also happening against Club Brugge as well, who really should have won that game, as I believe Lyon could have won that game. So for Pochettino, it's a huge problem, because, to be honest, when we think of the Mauricio Pochettino we've seen, be it with Espanyol or Southampton, or of course Tottenham, we tend to think of teams which are extremely proactive, which are very energetic, which apply high pressure, are making things very difficult for our opponent. PSG is not doing that. PSG is doing things, making things difficult for the opponent when they've got the ball and they're running with the ball. Yes, of course. When you've got Neymar and Mbappe, when you've got Messi, shouldn't forget that Messi, by the way, nearly scored the perfect free kick. I mean, he just hit the angle of the bar and the post, and he was not by any means the worst player in that PSG team. But there is this problem of imbalance, which is not a typical Pochettino problem, but which he has to solve with the players at his disposal. And you think, are you going to leave one of those guys on the bench? How will you justify it? People are waiting for the Magnificent Three to be there. But okay, that might have worked in the old days, you know, when Real Madrid was playing with Puskas and Coppa and Di Stefano and Rento, and that was okay because the defenses were not as well organized as they are now. Now they are organized, and you have a problem. You need to sacrifice a little bit of the sparkle, so to speak, to get some of the balance back. But to do that, you will have to leave one of those three players on the bench. And let's not forget Angel Di Maria, who has been one of the most consistent players for PSG. He's a wonderful player, especially in transitions, and who is also a player who is hardworking. Do you want to leave him out? Not necessarily. So it's a real conundrum, but Pochettino is not the first PSG manager to be faced with that one.
No, and I don't see an obvious solution either, I have to say, which is why this is all so interesting. And look, there is a rule. We spoke to Simon Cooper recently about his new book on Barcelona. There is a rule when you manage Messi, and it's very simple. You acquiesce to his every demand. And we got a glimpse. We got a glimpse of how he might react to not playing every minute. And it was interesting. I was just reading a piece in advance of talking to you, which was just charting. And there haven't been that many instances similar to substitutions or time off the pitch, because Messi's so damn good, of course, he played every game. But whenever he's taken off, it's always been an issue, and he's always been difficult. So, for instance, just to jog memories, 2008, Barcelona are 4-0 up. Messi is taken off in the 81st minute by Pep Guardiola. Now, that was the last time he did that. He refused to train the next day. He was that unhappy with being taken off. 2015, he's been away on international duty. It's January. And by the way, this is the year they won the treble. And Enrique leaves him on the bench. It was a defeat to Sociedad. He missed training. He skipped the annual visit to the children's hospital. Enrique was booed the next game. Xavi had to intervene and sort the whole thing out. Enrique later described it as a period of tension. So if you're Pochettino and you're playing in a big Champions League game, and in your heart of hearts you feel, oh, even though it's, you know, counterintuitive for any of us to say it, but that, you know, Mbappe, I need his pace, I want him starting. Neymar, I want him starting. I feel it's right to bring Messi off the bench with 20 minutes to go. Good luck with that. Like, good luck with that.
And good luck if you do the same with Neymar or Mbappe. Mbappe, perhaps, might be the disposable asset. I say might be. I'm literally just throwing hypothesis at you, because Mbappe, the relationship with the Parisian crowd is different because of what happened, and the fact that people are well aware of the fact that had there been some kind of agreement between Real Madrid and PSG, he would be wearing a white shirt right now. So it might be easier to do that. But yes, when it comes to Messi, but what can you say against that? I mean, it's like the arguments that people have about how big their name is on the poster of a film. You know, I mean, I'm going to take an example in cinema related to an actor who left us not very long ago, Jean-Paul Belmondo. You know, Jean-Paul Belmondo and Alain Delon, who were very, very close friends, and of course the two giants of the French screen for most of the 60s, 70s, and even the 80s. Jean-Paul Belmondo and Alain Delon didn't speak to each other for years. For the reason for it was because in a film that they did together, Borsalino, Alain Delon's name appeared twice on the poster, whereas Belmondo was only there once, and Delon was a producer. So that gives you an idea, I think, the kind of behavior that you can expect from this kind of people. I think it's funny more than anything else, and I think we shouldn't give it any importance whatsoever. Because you can be absolutely sure that the next time, even if Messi's left on the bench, the next time he's going to be on the pitch, even if he skips a training session, he will be doing his absolute darndest to be the best on the pitch, because there's one thing he is not. He's not that kind of player. He's not a selfish player who is going to... the real Messi is the one you see on the field of play. He's one of the most honest players that I think we've ever seen at this kind of level. Never complains, always carries on. Mm. If there's a ball to be given rather than shoot and it's the best choice to make, unlike some others, he will pass the ball. So in a way, we're, you know, talking as we do now, we're giving importance to something which really shouldn't have any. He's not the first player to have, you know, had a bad reaction to being substituted or forgotten. And he might have skipped a training session. I don't think you'd find a single example of Messi skipping a game, ever.
Ever. And to be honest, the point of this piece, just in case there's any you know, misunderstanding out there, is not that we think it's a big deal that Messi was in a huff when he was substituted. It's actually just so striking, like the extent of the headlines, like that this is global news and that Pochettino's having to explain himself in a press conference, the same way Solskjaer had to explain himself for taking off 36-year-old when they're down to 10 men and he took him off in like the 76th minute. It's that these two managers now, and it's amazing to watch the parallels, have to explain their every decision when it comes to these players, and it will be scrutinized beyond belief. And I don't know, it's just going to be fascinating to see how it plays out.
I can't wait. I it's a terrible thing to say. I can't wait for this age to be over. And I think it will be over when Messi and Ronaldo hang their boots, because I can't see anybody who is close to what they have been or what they are, or the kind of status they have in terms of social media and so forth, and how people become the whole thing about who's the greatest of the two, all this nonsense, really. And in a way, they're the victims of that too, because I think in a way it prevents us from actually realizing how great they have been and still are in some ways. And because we are focusing on these completely inconsequential stories. They're inconsequential, but I say that on the other hand, they're fascinating.
No, they're fascinating.
Because and they will have an impact on the way Pochettino is driving this PSG team forward, because there's going to be an impact, obviously.
Well, that's the question. And I guess it's fascinating because you're watching these greats with so much status and unbelievable amounts of credit in the bank, but they're raging against the dying of the light, and they're not going to be the first to admit it. And it's a difficult thing to have to nudge up beside them and say, look, I kind of think you're finished when it comes to this particular type of game I want to play this evening or whatever. So, look, this is a ridiculous question on the face of it to ask about Messi, obviously. But does he make, when it comes to, I'm not talking about, you know, when they're beating Strasbourg 4-2 at home and Clermont 4-0 and, you know, they're 6-6 in Ligue 1. When they get to knockout stages of the Champions League, does Messi with Neymar and Mbappe, does he make PSG more vulnerable or a better side than they were last year?
Both. And that's the problem. Of course, they're better because you have got a man who is one, if not the greatest player of all time, who is far from finished, and stroke of genius, he can change the games, and so can Neymar, and so can Mbappe. But it makes them worse, because there is simply no balance. And look at the teams which have won the Champions League in recent history. Chelsea, Bayern, yes, they've got some very fine players indeed, and some great players actually, in fact. But this is not the reason why they've won. This is not the reason why they've been so dominant. Look, even at Liverpool, they've got some magnificent players. I don't think Jurgen Klopp, when he wants to leave Salah out, or Mane out, or Firmino out, or Jota out, yes, there will be a few frowns and whatever, and people might talk about it for 15 seconds, but everybody will forget about it very quickly. It is a PSG problem. It is a problem that you have with teams of Galacticos. It's the problem that Real Madrid had. Think of the 2005-06 season when they had, my goodness, they had everybody. Mm. They had Ronaldo, the other one, the Fenomeno. They had Beckham. They had Duty. They had Raul. They had absolutely everybody who was anybody. And they were beaten 1-0 by Arsenal Football Club at the Bernabeu. And people ask themselves questions. Well, the answer to that was very simple. Your team is totally unbalanced, my dear Florentino Perez. It cannot work. It doesn't work like that. And it takes a very special manager like Like, for example, when Zidane did it, you know, when you had one, you know, Cristiano, Gareth Bale, and Benzema, and he managed to find some kind of balance there.
Mm.
But he was Zinedine Zidane, and you can do that if you're Zinedine Zidane.
And
Pochettino is not Zinedine Zidane.
No. And I mean, what was it Zidane said when they sold McAlealy? We have a Ferrari, we just sold the engine. So
yes,
you know,
yeah.
Players understand as well, which is the interesting thing. Yeah. Like, players know, and the PSG players will know that the collective maybe is more vulnerable. What of what of Neymar? Because I saw a couple of weeks back, and hey, look, we've all had a big meal on our holidays and been seen a photograph we don't love. I saw him on holidays, and he'd put on a few kilos, I think, and he was laughing off weight and fitness concerns. What mood has he returned in this season, Philippe?
Listen, Neymar is Neymar. He will never change, and he will always do this kind of thing. I think the mood is not particularly bad. I think he was genuinely delighted to see Leo Messi coming to PSG. He's such a frustrating player. I don't know what to say anything anymore, because to be honest, he sometimes gets a bad rap. You know, people say that he's not trying, and that's completely untrue. If you watch PSG week in, week out, you realize that Neymar is actually one of the players. Very often, he's the player who will react when something doesn't go right. He's the one who will rebel against that. He will not down tools or anything like that. He might do some very silly things. I mean, commit some silly fouls. He might dribble too much. He might not pass the ball when he should pass the ball, and so on. But he's not a player who becomes disinterested in what's happening around him. He cares an awful lot. And, you know, regardless of all the shenanigans, he cares an awful lot. So all I've heard about Neymar this season at PSG is that he actually approached the season in a really positive frame of mind. And he was delighted to be reunited with his friend from Barcelona. You know, they've only played 7 games so far this season. So let's see what it's like, you know, in a month, 2 months time, when the dust has settled a little bit. But yeah, it's true that with PSG, everything is a drama, everything is a soap opera, everything is a telenovela, whatever you want to call it. And it will carry on for our pleasure and sometime our despair at the state of world football. But we have to admit, all of us, that it is actually quite fun to watch.
Philippe, be under no illusion. When they signed Messi, we upgraded you to one of our speed dial numbers. We thought this is just going to be...
Oh, my goodness.
And a last one before you go. Mbappe, 4 goals and 3 assists in his 6 games.
Yes.
Obviously, the strong suspicion is that he's just counting down the clock and seeing out his contract. Is it your understanding, have PSG surrendered all hope of enticing him to sign a new deal, or where are they?
As it is right now, I think people are more or less... accepting of the fact that he will not wear the PSG shirt next season. And I think some people, including myself, were a little bit surprised that it didn't happen. But maybe, there's the whole financial context, there's the pandemic and so forth. But I would be very, very surprised if he were in a PSG shirt next season. And I would be very surprised if it's not an opinion that wasn't shared by the people at the head of the club, the Parisian club, that is.
Okay, very good. Great to have you on. Thanks so much, Philippe Auclair. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball.
Now, you're welcome, Max. So, Ireland 3-2 winners this evening against Australia at Tallaght Stadium. This is a 7-game run. Losing streak ended. A real morale booster, I guess, ahead of the World Cup qualifiers starting next month. Sweden and Finland to come in October. Will O'Callaghan was watching the game this evening. So, Will, I've been keeping an eye on it here. It looked lively. I mean, 5 goals for starters. So, I mean, it wasn't a stalemate or a grim affair by any means. But it looked like there were lots of chances. Looked like a kind of fast tempo, 90 minutes.
Yeah, I think it's a fair assessment. Plenty of chances at both ends. 4 of them scored in a pretty frantic first half, where both teams will feel, Joe, they should have scored more. But Ireland getting the decisive goal 5 minutes after halftime from Louise Quinn, who was named as the player of the game, had a really good performance defensively, particularly when Australia looked to turn the screw a bit in the last 15 minutes or so. Louise Quinn made 2 or 3 very important interceptions, particularly 2 crosses that come in from the right-hand side. And she marshalled the defence brilliantly, particularly when you consider that going into this game, people were talking about Sam Kerr's 100 cap and how many goals she was going to score against the Republic of Ireland in front of 4,000 people at Tallaght Stadium. And she was left a frustrated figure by the end, probably because of the way that Louise Quinn played. I thought Niamh Fahey had a really good game defensively, particularly in that second half too. And, you know, Ireland carried a threat going forward. I was a little bit concerned when I saw the team lineup that once again, Ireland were going with effectively a back five, where Katie McCabe is back trying to do a lot of work in the left wing back position, when Ireland really need to get her into attacking positions to unleash the most of her potential. But she's doing a very important role for the team, attacking deep from the left. Denise O'Sullivan played in a slightly more retreated role, back as more of a kind of a holding midfielder as opposed to playing as a number 10. And Amber Barrett was playing in an unusual position, not part of the front two, but playing behind them. And yet, it all seemed to click to create some chances in the first half, which is what I think would be the most pleasing thing for Vera Powell. And then second half, it was all about getting the result. As you mentioned, seven games played since March of 2020. The Republic of Ireland hadn't won under Vera Powell since the start of the pandemic. Played a lot of teams that were ranked above them during that period, and a couple of frustrating defeats, particularly against Iceland in the summer. But to actually hold on and to win the game 3-2 against a side who were ranked 11th in the world, Joe, and a team who got to the last four at the Olympics, beating Great Britain on the way to the semi-finals where they lost out to Ireland's next opponent, Sweden. This has to be a big morale booster going into particularly the matches with Sweden and Finland, four World Cup qualifiers this side of the end of the year.
Yeah, and Vera Powell was asked about that afterwards on TV, and, you know, the losing streak that is, and she said she was never worried about it, and it was very much, it seems, in so much as you can choose opposition, I suppose, but it was a concerted enough policy to try and give the Irish team game time against the best teams in the world in the hope that they'll grow, I suppose, more quickly and learn more quickly about how you have to play against the best sides in the world. So, in fairness, there is something admirable about that as opposed to going on a 7-match winning streak, which doesn't really bring the team on in any great way against lesser sides.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the men's international team going into the summer where they played Andorra, got a victory, and there wasn't a huge amount to take from the fact that they had beaten Andorra. And similarly, I think if back in the spring, if Stephen Kenny's side had beaten Qatar, people would have still pointed to the fact that when they played better opposition in the Nations League or in the World Cup qualifiers, they were losing those games. Like, I think you can probably break the Powell era into two parts. Very promising at the start, beating the teams they were expected to beat at the first half of that qualifying campaign for the European Championships, and then not getting the results, particularly the one away from home against Ukraine when the pressure was on, and taking a heavy enough defeat against Germany in the last fixture, that, you know, things were in the melting pot half to three quarters way through the campaign, and then didn't get the results, and then some poor results in friendly matches subsequently meant that a victory was really badly needed for this team. And, like, there's some new players and returning players who are fitting into the system here. Like, it was an extended squad that was called up, and I'm sure Lucy Quinn, who only qualified to play for Ireland a few days ago, the Birmingham striker, will be delighted to have gotten the score sheet technically. It may well, if it goes to a dubious goals committee, go down as an own goal for the Australian goalkeeper. But a well-struck free kick, which hit the post, came back and hit the Australian goalkeeper and went in, to have got a goal so early in the game, just 3 minutes into your first international, has to be a big boost. And that's been a question mark over this Irish team too, has been trying to find an attacker who can score the goals, because this Republic of Ireland team have been quite good until they get to the box, and then been short when it came to having a goal score. You know, Louise Kiernan back in the squad, she got on during the second half too. She's playing with Liverpool in the second flight in England currently. But Lucy Quinn just bolsters those options a little bit. And that's why it was intriguing to see that Amber Barrett was playing in a retreated role, because I thought Heather Payne, if Louise Quinn was named player of the game, Heather Payne can feel very unfortunate that she wasn't named player of the game. The work that she got through tonight, Joe, was remarkable. She actually led the line in that second half at times when possession was being lost. She hassled and she harried against the Australian defence on numerous occasions. And that, I think, has to be seen as one of the real positives coming out of this. It's now probably going to be a case for the World Cup qualifiers of who partners Payne up front, as opposed to trying to find maybe two strikers or a lone striker to do that job.
Right, okay. So again, by the way, for anyone tuning in, Will mentioned Lucy Quinn on her debut. She scored a free kick early on, 27 years of age. The brilliant Denise O'Sullivan with the second, although took a huge deflection. To be fair, one of the Australian goals took a wicked deflection as well. So we'll call that quits. And then Louise Quinn, header from a corner, now at Birmingham, of course, after her time in Italy. That's her 12th international goal, which is no mean feat for a centre half. Look, it's silly of us to sit here and say everything's great and everything's perfect. There are kind of areas of concern or areas of you know, areas for improvement. The goalkeeping position, Courtney Brosnan was in goals again this evening. Like, you'd have to chalk the Mary Fowler goal up as a mistake on her part. And maybe, Will, there were one or two other moments. There was a heavy touch when Sam Kerr closed her down. The ball went wide. There was a dropping ball spilled. You couldn't say there was huge security back there in the goalkeeping position this evening. Not that it was a disastrous performance either, to be fair.
No, she made a couple of good saves after the first one. And if you're looking at your goalkeeper when, let's be fair, she had a howler for the Mary Fowler goal that went in for the equaliser. It was a shot that was right down the middle of the goal, and Brosnan didn't get down well at all and deflected the ball into her own net. And like, that's a routine save which a goalkeeper should be making at international level. And yeah, there was a couple of times that she got caught with the ball at her feet and maybe was lucky that Australia didn't take more advantage of it. And then, like, she made a couple of good saves, but you're thinking that if you're Brosnan coming in for this game, having lost her place to Maloney at the end of the qualifying campaign last time around, like, Grace Maloney's done nothing wrong since coming in, but Maloney was sick last week, Farrah Powell explained before the game, so Brosnan got a chance to impress ahead of the World Cup qualifiers. She's definitely not going to want to see a replay of that first Australian goal. And Mary Fowler, I thought, Joe, had a really good game. I remember Colin Bell talking about her back in 2017 or 2018 when he was the manager. He was trying to get her to declare for the Republic of Ireland at that time because she was getting ready to play her club football in Europe, and her dad is Irish, as you can guess by the name. And the hope was that she might declare at that point. It's a pity she didn't, because I thought she was the best Australian player on show tonight. Was really dangerous, wasn't afraid to get a shot off. As with that goal, it's like you take a chance and the goalkeeper makes a mistake. But she got across the front three for Australia this evening. Powerful runner with the ball at her feet too. One that definitely feels like they got away, even though she was born and grew up in Australia. So understandable that she would declare for the nation of her birth. But a pity we couldn't get her, because that type of player would make a big difference, I think, in the Republic of Ireland setup if she was available to play. But yeah, I think defensively they had to dig in at times. And that's why Louise Quinn is getting player of the game. It's not just because she headed the winner early in the second half of the game, it's because of some of the backs of the wall defending that she had to put in. But Vera Powell would probably turn around and say to me, the most important thing is that Ireland didn't concede in that last 15-20 minutes when Australia had a lot of the ball. They were up against one of the best strikers in world football in Sam Kerr. They were able to frustrate her for the night and she wasn't able to score. And that defensively is something that they can build on against both Sweden and Finland.
Yeah, I'm just watching some of the interviews. Obviously, can't hear them, but you're seeing lots of smiles, and you would detect in the body language a real sense of relief. Vera Powell was, you know, thrilled with the win, all smiles and like lots of fist bumps. This wasn't a team kind of treating this as a friendly. It was, you get the feeling, a pretty important night for them all, because for the first time, I would say, in the build up to this match, definitely in the media, one detected a bit of pressure on Vera Powell, like the 7-match losing streak, the way that the Euros campaign finished, the second half of it after they'd got themselves in such a great position. Definitely, there was probably a sense we're going into two crucial World Cup qualifiers on the back of an 8-match losing streak and potentially, you know, disappointing performance and or result this evening. And I don't know, like, there would have been just a bit of negativity in the mood music around the team itself, especially when everything else is going so well in terms of things like the Sky sponsorship. Yeah. And, you know, the resources now are so much better and the parity of pay with the men. There would have been a sense of, come on, time to deliver here. And so I think you're seeing a lot of that in the body language tonight with their relief, the smiles. It's a little bit more than just a, you know, a forgettable friendly win for them.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, because Vera Powell was speaking to Stephen Doyle a couple of weeks ago when the Sky deal was announced as the shirt sponsor, and it was right on the back of the pay parity for international appearances for the men's and women's national teams. And you've got all this kind of good energy, particularly on the back of the Sky deal. It would have let the air out of the balloon slightly if Australia come over and played particularly well against the Republic of Ireland, and say if they've taken a defeat in Tala, you're then facing into a Sweden game where I think very few people would expect Ireland to be beating Sweden. Sweden are going to be one of the top teams in qualifying for the next World Cup, so that's a very difficult game ahead. But you go in with the question marks no longer there about the losing streak, on the back of a morale-boosting victory. And there were plenty of newspaper editorials over the last couple of days, and even go back to last weekend, which was, have we maybe been a bit too soft on Vera Powell along the way, where we thought that was a good qualifying campaign, but ultimately they weren't able to get the job done. And there haven't really been great signs in the friendlies that have been played since. The narrative would have very much stuck on a losing run going back to March of last year. And particularly if they were to lose to Sweden at that point in the first of the qualifiers, you would think think that the pressure would definitely be on Vera Pau at that stage. But she can turn around now and say she's had some returning players coming back into the squad. Like, great to see Claire Shine, who scored a remarkable goal for Glasgow in the Champions League qualifiers a few weeks ago, who has been through so many issues in her own life over the last few years, to be back into the squad again is a big morale booster too. And these players coming back in just adds an extra bit of competition along the way. And some of the injured players who weren't available this time round, you know, like, say, Little John, who would have probably started in midfield, should be back for the game next time round. And there's also a good supply of players now, particularly with Birmingham City, creating a mini Irish camp currently, and a lot of Irish players going to Liverpool in the second flight in England, who are now getting regular football at a good level there. Mm. And they've been taking a good look at the camps for the Women's National League teams. I'm intrigued to see, Joe, whether the likes of, say, Sarah Rowe, who trained with that home-based squad after she signed with Shelburne, can now push to get a place into the Irish team, or whether she's going to go back to Australia. And Noonan, such a star for the Cork Ladies footballers, has been involved in Republic of Ireland squads too, and gave up ladies football this summer to try and make the senior squad, and has been named in the last couple of squads. Is she going to break through and add an extra bit of competition too? So Vera Pau is getting a few more options along the way, which I'm sure she's going to welcome as well.
Yeah, I think what added to the pressure and those editorials that you mentioned was the way Northern Ireland dispatched of Ukraine in the qualifiers. You know, it was 4-1 in aggregate. They eased through. They were missing a number of players. Ireland, the Republic, have a population advantage and, you know, players playing at a higher level, really. So suddenly, I think it was such a direct comparison. You know, the way Ireland had struggled against Ukraine, hadn't, you know, put themselves in a playoff position, and then Northern Ireland just dispatched of that opposition. So I think that probably added to this sense of, well, hang on here, do we need to re-examine the job Vera Pau has actually done?
Well, what amplified that too was that Kenny Shields went in pretty late in the journey to become the Northern Ireland Women's National Team manager too. And he was able to get that group of players together to play at a fairly high octane, fairly high work rate, where they were able to beat Ukraine. I watched their playoffs before the European Championships, and Northern Ireland were excellent with, I would say, a lower quality of player across the board. Definitely. Than the Republic of Ireland have. Which was why it felt even more like a golden opportunity was missed away from home against Ukraine. And I know there was a couple of moments in that game, McCabe hitting the woodwork with the penalty, the bizarre nature of the Onion O'Gorman own goal, which slipped past Brosnan into the net at the time. Like, there are individual errors that happen along the way and bits of bad luck, but you couldn't but look at Northern Ireland and think, right, they've come together with the team who are inferior to the Republic of Ireland on paper, but yet they're able to get the job done in two playoffs to make sure that they go to the championships. So, yeah, there's no doubt that that put pressure along the way. And, like, to have missed out on the Europeans to be played in England as well, that would have been a huge boost to go along. And it seemed like after the Republic of Ireland started so well, Joe, that all they had to do realistically was pick up 3 points against Ukraine and they could have automatically qualified for the finals. And to have missed out on that was a real killer, I'd agree.
Yeah. So that brings us nicely to where we are now. Friendly this evening, really good win, as you said, against the 11th best team in the world. Ireland are ranked 33rd. And from next month, the World Cup qualifiers get underway for World Cup 2023. Sweden, who should top the group realistically, and Finland. The other teams in the group, if people didn't catch it, Slovakia and Georgia. Basically, Sweden likely winners and Ireland fighting it out for that playoff spot. And you would say, like, very, very doable, very, very much within their grasp.
Yeah, look, I mean, the equation is fairly simple. You take the two bottom teams in the group with Georgia and Slovakia, you'd be expected to win the games home and away against them if you're going to finish in second place in this group. Anything picked up against Sweden would be a bonus. Now, Australia were missing a few players, but still had a lot of their women's league players from England particularly playing tonight. So it was still a strong 11 that they had out. But they lost out 1-0 to Sweden in the Olympics just a couple of months ago in Tokyo. So that might just give you an idea of how close Australia can be to Sweden on their day. And the Republic of Ireland have beaten Australia. So this is the perfect fixture in so many ways to get ready for the Sweden fixture. But yeah, Joe, you'd expect that Sweden are going to take this group, and they won't probably sweep it, but they'll be a bit like Germany in our European group, where they'll be expected to win all the fixtures that they play. The Republic of Ireland will be hoping that there's maybe a few draws along the way between the two Nordic rivals in Sweden and Finland, because Finland are likely to be the Republic of Ireland's main threat when it comes to these qualifiers. And, you know, if they can turn Tallaght Stadium into a little bit of a fortress, and again, it was good to see 4,000 supporters there tonight, where the team has been playing without supporters for so long, and many of them, you know, young fans who are going in. Like, I was chatting to our own colleague Phil Egan, who was going along and bringing some of his niece and nephews along to watch the game tonight. Great to to see them get exposure to watch some international football along the way. And if Ireland can get some good results at home and be sticky and difficult to beat like they were in the second half of the game, there's no reason to think that this Republic of Ireland team can't go on and give it a good shot at qualifying. But yeah, I mean, Sweden is difficult. And what a way to have to start to play Sweden in the first qualifier. Yeah. That's going to be a real test of where Ireland really are.
Yeah, the Tallaght Stadium thing is working out quite well. Bit of a rhythm there, a bit of familiarity. Good size stadium for, you know, good atmosphere and fans.
Great surface, yeah. Fantastic place to play.
Yeah, it's kind of ideal for where the team is at the moment. So, look, we'll be talking about this, I'm sure, plenty next month. But a win for Ireland this evening ends that 7-match losing streak, 3-2 win against Australia, and we'll reconvene next October.